You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the very best things, in fact, the very best thing about being the host of Stateside for more than 7 years is talking to and meeting so many interesting, smart, accomplished people. And all so often I'd come back to the Stateside office and I would say to the producer team, I just had the best time talking to so-and-so. Boy, would it be cool to get some of these folks around the table at a dinner party, sit them down, pour wine, and talk about anything and everything. So on this final week of my broadcasting career, we have lined up a few dream dinner party conversations with some of our favorite guests and friends. Today, we have Gleaves Whitney, director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University, and Michigan State University professor of economics, Charlie Ballard. Hello to both of you.
Hi, Cindy.
I'm so glad you were both able to join me because I have really, really enjoyed talking with you over the years here on Stateside. You know, and as we talked, I quickly realized you are both very fun to talk to, and you have a gift for making your subjects of history and economics super, super interesting. You know, Charlie, when you were just starting school and still figuring things out, was being an economist and teaching in a university, is that what you had in mind?
Well, I got pretty close to that by the time that I was a junior in college. In my sophomore year in college, I took a course from the late Wallace Oates, a great professor, and that really changed my life. And I learned a lot in that and really enjoyed it. And I thought, hey, that might be a career. And so pretty soon I started asking my faculty members about what it would be like to go to graduate school in economics, and they gave me advice. Now, the hardest part was that my mother had been planning for me to be an attorney, I think since the day I was born.
Oh, wow.
And so when I was a teenager, every time there was an attorney in the room, I would get to introduce to him. And so at some point, I knew that I was going to have to explain to my mother that I didn't think I was going to go to law school. And I was afraid that that she might die, but she didn't. And sure enough, by about 3 years later, she had enrolled in law school. If the kid wasn't going to do it, by golly, somebody in our family is going to be a lawyer. And my mom, I think she passed the bar when she was 55 years old.
That is super, super inspiring. Gleaves, how about you? I mean, the idea of your focus on presidential history, when you were back, before you really landed on it, what did you think you were going to be?
Well, I really thought that history was always fascinating. I grew up in Texas, and of course, Texans have this sense of history because of the Alamo and the Battle of San Jacinto and all this. And so I was always fascinated to understand the past. And I understood by the time I was an undergraduate with great, great teachers that history is the lab of the human experience. And you can see everything that humans attempt to do, fail to do, succeed. And I just thought it was a lot of fun to learn about those things, and it made me a lot more interesting. And let me say, you know, since you are hosting this dinner party, and you host a heck of a great party, Cindy, it's precisely at times like this when I can appreciate what my professors tried to instill in me, and that was a broad liberal education so that I could address whatever the topic was that was thrown out on the table. What was the human experience with that topic, with freedom, with equality, with, well, like Charlie's field, with trying to generate wealth and what you do in a world of scarce resources? I mean, this is just a intrinsically fascinating thing to do.
When I think about both of your fields and my career path, because if you had seen me my freshman year of college at the then University of Detroit, I would have never believed I would have been sitting here at the end of 40 years in broadcasting. I wanted to be a physician. I was in pre-med, and I was weeping my way through calculus and weeping my way through inorganic chemistry. And no matter how hard I would study, I would get a C. If I didn't, I'd get a C. And if I killed myself studying, I got a C. But meantime, history was, it was like delicious to go to class. And so by my sophomore year, I'd moved over to a history major. And I remember my senior year was the big aha moment when it all connected. So my macroeconomics class connected with the psychology class, which connected with the history. And that moment of, wow, realizing how everything connects. And that was the liberal arts moment that I agree with you. It kind of gets you ready to be able to say something about and understand how we're connected.
You're maybe not a physician of the human body, but you're a physician of the soul of the body politic. I mean, this is what historians can be.
You know, that's the wonderful thing about the social sciences is that they're all connected.
Yeah.
History, economics, political science, sociology, the boundaries between these disciplines are, in a lot of cases, kind of fuzzy because they all interact with each other. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about my career is that I'm able to bring a historical and institutional and political perspective to thinking about economic issues, which I think is a really fun thing to do.
And I've got to imagine helps make it alive for the kids. And it made me wonder, just as you think of working with kids, what is the secret sauce that you both find to take a subject that in other hands would put people to sleep, but it makes it alive and interesting?
Well, one of the things, speaking for myself, that I try to do is I try to internalize what I want to say before I actually go before an audience. So I might have notes to refer to if I just want to stay on track, but I go in there with the stories and the analytical points I want to make, and I try to get away from the lectern. I stand in front of the audience. It can be a little scary sometimes, but you just look them in the eye and you take their questions, you read their body language, and you can tell when you're hitting on all eight cylinders, and then the stories are firing their imagination, and that to me is the most satisfying thing to do. And it's not just the youngins that this works with. I also teach a number of classes at Aquinas College, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute over there for older learners. They're, I think, 50 years up. And they are hungry to learn history. And that changes the dynamic as well. So many times they come up to me after class and they say, you know, I goofed off in history, or my coach was my history teacher in high school. I didn't appreciate history. And now that I'm 60, 70 years old, I'm hungry to understand where we've been so I can figure out where we're going.
Do you remember your first time in front of a class, which I'm betting probably happened when you were grad students, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Were you scared?
Well, I'm an introvert, and believe it or not, I'm really pretty shy. I mean, if I have a job to do, then I can become my extrovert persona, but that's because I have a job in public to do. But by nature, I am not somebody who likes to get out there and do that kind of thing.
Huh.
But again, you give me a job as a teacher, I really enjoy that because it's about the students. And one of the things I learned really early on, and again, I credit mentors who said this, my mentor in teaching my first class said, remember, the students already know an amazing amount, and your job is to bring out through everyday experiences they've had the lessons you're trying to impart. And so by having a more open forum, so it's not just a long lecture format with the students would be entering the conversation, and that's when they started to really learn from each other, and I would learn too.
Did you feel, Charlie, when you come on and talk economics with us, it's just, this is, as you say, firing on all cylinders. Did it take a while to kind of build that that ability?
Absolutely. I think it's like almost all human activities. You get better with practice. You asked whether I was scared. Yeah, I was scared. First time I get up in front of a class, which I think was in 1981, I hadn't had previous experience, I think I did okay, but I've learned so many things since then about how to connect with an audience, how to present the material, and so I think, you know, that's the reason that the veterans contribute more to their sports team than the rookies, and that's the reason why the more experienced in almost any walk of life, experience makes a big difference.
Fun.
Charlie, I'm just thinking what you said. You and I are the same vintage because my first experience in a classroom was also 1981. And, you know, a question that I get, and Charlie, I wonder if you get this question a lot too. You know, students were different. Well, they were all like Cindy in those days. You know, intellectually curious. No, I'm exaggerating a little bit. Cindy would have been the A-plus student.
I was definitely in the front row.
You were definitely
waving
in the front
my
row.
Hand.
We know that. But but there have been changes. Charlie and I have had a chance now to look at a couple of different generations go through the system. Mm-hmm. And they reflect really profound changes in our country.
What kind of changes? What have you seen?
Charlie, I think you and I probably both would agree that the social platforms, you know, social media have had an enormous impact on the way students learn.
Yeah, I would say that the biggest thing that has improved our students' ability to learn has been the presence of all of these digital technologies that did not exist when I started teaching. But I will also say that the biggest thing that has harmed our students' ability to learn is all these digital technologies. I mean, one of the big challenges that I have is that I know that there are students who are surfing the web on their phone when they should be paying attention to what's going on in class. So it's both a huge plus and a huge minus. You know, Gleaves, before we go on, you not only are we contemporaries, but you said you're from Texas. Well, I grew up in Texas, too. Where are you from?
I'm from Houston.
Houston? City of Houston?
Yes.
Well, I grew up in Lake Jackson. You know where Lake Jackson
yes,
is?
Yes, I do. You were just a little bit southwest.
Yeah, just south of me. About 45 minutes to an hour due south of Houston.
Listen to that speech change as you start talking about being south of Houston.
Well, I guess, me a Lone Star beer and we're both going to be talking like this in no time.
All right. All right, sure enough.
Wow.
Cindy, you did a great job putting sitting two people next to each other.
Your speech is, you know, you're like my husband when he goes back to Ireland. We've had him over here now. He came here. I met him in school when I was a junior. I did my junior year at University College Cork. I came home with a Cork inflection, which every time I go back, I get a vaccination. But he came over here to marry me in February of 1976. So when he goes back to Cork, he gets a lot of teasing about sounding like a Yank. But you can hear it come out, especially watching sports. And suddenly you're like, all right, bye. And you hear that Cork accent coming out. But you just morphed. It was delicious, delicious to hear.
Well, pretty soon we'll be eating red beans and rice and collard greens.
I love it. Real quick, I'm interested in, for each of you, who's your personal hero?
Oh, gosh.
Charlie, why don't you take that one first?
Well, I have a lot of heroes, but I think I would put Abraham Lincoln at the top of the list.
Why is that?
Well, a whole bunch of reasons. One, I think he's the most important, the greatest president we've ever had. Certainly no other president faced the challenges that he did, the challenge of trying to preserve something like a democracy in the midst of a civil war. But there's more than that. I'm actually distantly related to Abraham Lincoln. I think he's something like a sixth cousin once removed or something. But more than that, even more than that, one of my great-great-grandfathers served in the 26th Texas Cavalry Regiment. You can tell if you know your geography. Mm-hmm. He was on the losing side.
Yes, he was wearing the butternut color.
his wife gave birth in July of 1865. That is 3 months after Abraham Lincoln died. Gave birth to a son, and they gave him the middle name Lincoln as an emblem, I believe, of their belief that the war was over and it was time to bind up the nation's wounds. Mm-hmm. And then 3 generations later, Lincoln is my middle name.
Awesome. I love that story. How about you, Gleaves? Who's your personal hero?
Well, first of all, let me say, I think that's really neat. And Charlie, you'll know what I'm talking about when I say, you know, when we were growing up down in Texas, it was hard to praise Lincoln. And one of the biggest transformations in my education was actually, you know, after coming up north and going to graduate school at the University of Michigan and reading the incredible literature that had been produced about Lincoln that had sort of been contraband in the public schools in Houston to some extent. And so I really, my hat's off to you. And I had no idea you had that personal connection, Charlie. But I would say, going back a little bit further, I'd go back to George Washington, because here's somebody who knew how to handle power and how to let go, relinquish power when he had to. And that's just the kind of person you want to be a president or the leader of your people, somebody who doesn't need the power. Now, when he was a young man, of course, he was ambitious. But remember, he resigned his commission from the Continental Army in 1783, right after the British surrendered and signed that Paris Peace Accord. He stepped back after the Constitutional Convention of 1787. He spoke very rarely, just a couple of times, points of order during the proceedings themselves. He did not try to dominate it. It was understood he would be the first president, but I mean, he did not lord it over people. And then, of course, he only wanted that first term, but he was prevailed upon to run again as president of the United States. So he did just a wonderful service to posterity by saying, I will not run again. Two terms is enough. You need to find new and vigorous young leadership. So that is a lesson, I think, for the ages. And in fact, if I can just tell you a quick story about that. King George III was having his portrait painted. Artist named West was painting the portrait, and West was trying to explain to King George III that Washington was somebody who could relinquish power, and he went through all the ways that Washington had stepped back. This fierce man, this man with a fierce temper. I mean, there's nothing milquetoast about him at all, but when it came to Republican principle and stepping back from power, Washington had it. So George III is listening to this, and he said, if all that you say is true, then George Washington's the greatest man who's ever lived.
Interesting. And actually, as you're talking about this, it reminds me how skillfully Lin-Manuel Miranda kind of worked that into Hamilton, because you have King George saying, I wasn't aware that was a thing a person could do, what he heard. And I think one of the high points of that play, of that musical, is One Last Time. We're going to teach him how to say goodbye. And it kind of expressing all of that in today's music. That's fabulous.
Cleves, don't you? I mean, I think historians are in general agreement that Washington's decision to step down after two terms was one of the most important turning points in all of American history.
Yes, that's true, and it became sort of just an unconventional rule. It wasn't written down any place. It wasn't codified anywhere, where presidents were afraid to run for more than two terms. Grant, for example, considered it, but then he wisely backed off running for a third term. And of course, FDR then is the one who actually does it in 1940, when the nation is on the precipice of war. And he knew he could get away with it at that point.
We could do this all night. You are too fun, both of you. Thank you. Thank you so much for giving us your time over the years while I was here on Stateside. The show continues, but I will be listening at home as you get called to contribute to Stateside. But this has been terrific. Cleves Whitney with Grand Valley State University, where he directs the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies, and Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. Thank you so much for being part of my dinner conversation.
And congratulations to you, Cindy, for 40 years of just wonderful public service to us all.
Thank you.
I'm going to miss you.
Thanks for the great work that you and your team at Michigan Radio do. It's really been a pleasure.